Hello and welcome once again to In Their Shoes. My name is Vanessa Coleman, and today my guest is Charles Henley, who is a retired daycare centre manager for social services. So welcome to In Their Shoes, Charles.
Yep. Thank you, Vanessa.
So perhaps you could tell us, when did you first become a daycare centre manager? What era are we talking about?
I retired in 1990 after spending 25 years going through the ranks, starting at the lowest position in daycare work with people with learning disabilities, and retired as a manager at Hastings in East Sussex.
So did you work in Hastings all of the time? Was that your...
Oh, no. I had a very varied career, fortunately, very fortunately, because it gave me an insight into more than just one position, one job, one authority.
What did you do before, if you don't mind me saying that you are the ripe old age of 90?
You're perfectly right.
You look wonderful, except you have got a bit of a black eye today. I mean, have you been upsetting the neighbours or something?
No. I upset a garden rake, which resented being stood on.
Right. Okay.
It struck back.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about your life. Where were you born?
In London.
In London, yeah.
Kensington.
In Kensington. Oh, posh part?
Yeah, I don't know if we were very posh, but that's where I was born. I had no choice.
So, and how did you spend your early years? So what year were you born in then?
1924.
Gosh, things have changed since 1924.
They've changed. They certainly have.
So anyway, a quick potted version of before life, before being a manager at a daycare centre. How did you spend your years? Did you go to university?
No, I left school at 14.
14. Was that the time when... Is that all you had to do in those days? Go to finish in 14 or what? What was the
that
system?
That was the statutory finishing time for elementary education.
Oh.
Yeah. After that, if you were fortunate, you were able to go to a grammar school or a technical college or whatever. But the war came along shortly after I was... The age, well, not shortly after leaving school. I left school, that would have been 38. As you know, the war started a couple of years later. In the early days, I worked in an office in London, in the city, when I was 18 and a half. The war was on, I joined the Air Force. I was on flying duties for a couple of years. At the time when the war was on, a year after it started, we were living in the east side of London, Dagenham.
Oh, dodgy.
Right along. Within the first year, we were bombed out, and we became one of those refugees wandering around with a bundle of clothes or a case in our hand, with temporary accommodation and what have you.
Still in London? You weren't...
Still in London, yeah.
No, you weren't sent to Wales then?
Oh, no, the family. We weren't sent anywhere. Uh-huh. Which was fortunate, because it was an interesting time, of course, for a young person.
Was it? What was interesting?
What was interesting was the war going on, and there were...
Oh, I wouldn't have thought it. Well, I suppose interesting, but frightening.
For an 18-year-old, well, at least I was a 14, 15-year-old, moving into the war, 1939, quiet war for a year, and then the air raid started. Within the first few months, we were bombed out. We were fortunate, we survived. The bomb that blew us apart killed six people. The second bomb dropped at the same time, killed 24 people. So we were the lucky ones.
So the gods they didn't want you to go just yet. You had plenty of work to do then ahead of you.
I was kept for something. For what reason? I don't know. But
destiny. Well, yes, you've done a lot of amazing things, obviously, since then. So anyway, you managed to... So you were in the Air Force then?
I was in the Air Force, but it was... anti-climax, because when the war finished, I was on a squadron, but it was not totally operational in the sense of being exciting as one would expect it to be if you're an 18-year-old, 19-year-old.
Yeah.
But I survived, which was in one way fortunate. Yeah. The other was I was also disappointed that I hadn't completed what I felt I was... going to enjoy even more. I know. I mean, really, to be honest, in some ways I'm not unhappy about it, because if I'd gone on to Bomber Command, as I was keen to do, I would probably be having recriminations now about whether my role in life had been to blow people out of existence.
Yeah.
So in a way, it's got its compensations.
I think you have to accept the cards that you're given in life and make the best of it.
Yeah. Anyway, I stayed in the Air Force, got married before I came out.
How old were you when you got married?
21, I think.
So in those days, do you find that people got married at a young... Because it's young for a man.
Oh, yeah. No.
Do you think it was because of the war that people thought, well, live for today more?
There were a lot of wartime marriages like that, yes, definitely.
And did your marriage last?
66 years.
66 years, wow. Yeah. So that was it. Wonderful.
Yeah. No, it was quite normal then for people to get married in their early 20s.
Mm.
But, yes, I had 66 years with my
wonderful
good lady, who, fortunately, again, because I was a very unsettled person when I left the services, very unsettled, and I wasn't an easy person to live with.
Mm.
But she stood in there, stuck in there, and I went back to my old job, which in those days I had to retain for you.
Yeah.
If you're in the forces, you left your firm, you had a job to go back to. Mm. It was actually
That compulsory? Did they have to take you back?
Yeah. That was accepted.
Yeah, good.
That if you were caught to the colours.
And
sure enough, interestingly, it was an interesting job in many ways. It was for the old Lagonda Motor Company.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, that doesn't mean anything Lagonda, to me.
No, but it will have looked like the old timers. Bentleys and Lagondas are from the same. Anyway, that's incidental.
Yeah.
Because when I went back, I didn't stay.
No.
I was
and very, you got itchy feet?
I had then.
Yeah.
That's what I say. I wasn't an easy person to live with. So my good-natured wife put up with me. I left the job, took up a new line, and that was working for IBM.
Oh, yeah.
And training as a service engineer in one of their divisions.
Mm.
They had three divisions, computers, typewriters, and time control. I was in the time control. I stuck that, partly stuck it is the word. Working for IBM, you think you've got it made, but IBM had bought out the company I worked for to get a foot in this country.
Mm.
And they weren't really interested in our division.
Well, IBM, is that American?
International Business Machines. Biggest computer firm in the world.
Mm.
At one time, they were then. They were the leading people.
Mm.
IBM, I mean, even now you see their name fleshing up when there's sports events on.
Yeah.
You've got to be in there. But anyway, I got very disenchanted with IBM because the part I was in was backward-looking. I travelled everywhere by bus and train, and I had a territory that stretched from the beginning of Hampshire down to the end of Dorset and across to Wiltshire. But I stayed because there was a feeling at one time IBM would take control of the company and then we really would be in the clover. But at the end of the day, IBM sold us out.
Mm-hmm.
It was one of the original sellouts to the staff. But the engineers didn't get a very good deal.
So what, you could all buy shares in the company and run it?
No, you were given shares.
Given shares, yeah.
There wasn't to be a payoff. You would be given shares in a new company that would be formed independent of IBM. But the deal wasn't a good deal. And I had no respect for the people I was working for.
Mm.
So I resigned.
We need to fast forward because I really want to talk about your main thing now is that you've written books about disabilities. What was the first thing that got you involved and what age were you to do with people with disabilities?
Well, just to make the gap, when I left IBM, I went into an unsettled period for 2 years. And during that time, I came across a training centre for people with learning disabilities.
Oh, right.
So in that couple of years, it was a dramatic change. I'd gone through several jobs.
Yeah.
But they brought me into working with people with learning disabilities. It wasn't altruism. I didn't go into this work because I was altruistic and I saw wonderful people, I can do a job with them.
Yeah.
I went in because I thought, gosh, I want to really be a teacher.
Yeah.
And if I get a job with these people, it would be a good stepping stone to take me forward. I was nearly 40.
40, so it's 50 years ago, half a century.
50 years, it is 50 years
yeah,
ago.
50 yeah,
50
years,
it is a 50 years ago.
Yeah.
But again, that wasn't straight in. First job I got was in Poole.
Poole,
in an old house, a beaten up old house at Ashley Cross. But there was a community spirit there. There was a nice feeling.
So would you describe this then as a daycare centre? What we
would
know?
It was a daycare centre. Mm. And at that time, it wasn't just adults, it was children. Children and adults were
from what age were the children then?
Any age. That we had a special needs unit in with, or they were almost babies.
So there wasn't schools? I mean, you know, because Elizabeth went to Linwood School. Were there not schools in those days?
They were considered uneducable. That was a label. But it was a good job. It was on a 6 month appointment, temporary job, because somebody was finishing a course. I was told there would be a permanent job for me because they were going through a transition period, going from occupation centres where they were just looked after and treated as children into an adult world where they were to be seen as adults who had potential to be employable and to come into the world. I had a permanent job in Bournemouth, having gone through about four different posts. It was ideal. But unfortunately, the early stages, learning disabilities was controlled by the Medical Officer of Health and the local authority, who delegated the responsibility of daycare to daycare managers and to residential places to residential officers. They were monitored by the mental welfare officer, who was a specialist, and the ideal link between families and the practice in the residential and daycare centres. That was fine because the medical officer was aware of the limitations and capabilities and the direction we were heading, and he was totally supportive. The mental welfare officer was the man who monitored that the parents were happy and we were doing a good job.
Looking back, you think that was a good setup?
That was an ideal setup.
Ideal.
Ideal, because the managers like myself, well, I wasn't a manager initially, but I got to be the manager.
Mm.
But the staff, the practitioners, were helped by the people who started care in the community.
Yeah.
Care in the community. It was started by a psychologist who worked in the big hospitals, 1,000 beds, 2,000 beds. But that's where these people were, in that kind of numbers.
So are you saying that people with disabilities then were in big hospitals?
Yes, they were mental institutions.
Yeah.
They had limited staff. There were efforts in some of them to improve things, but it was no life. Some of these people had been sent into these institutions for the weakest of reasons. Some of them were for reasons of immorality. If a girl had a baby, she was considered a moral defective and she was put in an institution.
So even though she was compos mentis and okay,
exactly,
just because of that, it's terrible.
Exactly.
So are we saying that somebody like my daughter, Elizabeth, with her learning difficulties, would she then have been put in this kind of place?
Unless you were prepared to look after her 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. Because apart from a few occupation centres, day centres, there was no support in the community for people with learning disabilities.
That's terrible.
There was nothing. I mean, that's why, I mean, there were 50,000 people in hospitals when they started to run them down. 50,000.
Yeah. So we've gone a step in the right direction. We've gone from the hospital institution to these daycare centres where people would go home then at night.
There was a whole range of options. The families who could keep their children now took them back because there was support.
Yeah.
Those that couldn't cope had them in either hostels or group homes where they were resident. There's a whole range of options. If the families, bless their hearts, which because they're saints in those days, could keep them and they sent them to the day centre every day, they had a bit of life.
Mm.
They were happy that their children were actually being looked after.
On a score of 1 to 10, how would you say those daycare centres were in that particular time?
At that particular time, you'd be going right through the scale from 1 to 10, in as much as it was a transition time.
It was trial and error, wasn't it?
It was totally trial and error.
People's hearts were in the right place and that everybody was trying. Would I'm right? And everybody was trying to do the best for these people.
There was a movement afoot to do the best for these people. Yeah. Believe it or not, Enoch Powell was one of the people who started it.
He's
the only minister that I'm aware of that showed the depth of feeling for people with learning disabilities. And he changed the course of history.
I don't think a lot of people would know that, would they?
They don't. Talk of Enoch Powell and
his rivers of blood and all that. Yeah.
But Enoch Powell was a caring man. Mm. And it was through him, really, that this got in any direction.
Mm.
But the support was varied. The quality of service, obviously, was very varied. Initially, people coming out of institutions were treated as children. They were never going to grow up.
Mm.
So you entertain them, you contain them.
Yeah.
And this went through an evolution, going to an extreme where they were all going to go to work and they could all be employed. That faded as the realisation stepped in that only so much of this was practical. I mean, I came in, 1966 I actually came in.
Mm.
And it was in the process then. It was just moving over where we'd stop treating them as children, the grown-ups, but they were still in the same centres, sharing space. But we were looking at them from a different angle. There were people who were against it. They were against the concept and interpreted day centres in the community as being the same as 1,000-bedded institutions.
No.
But, yeah, so change took place against a background of foment of you've got clashes between two groups of people. One who wanted to change, the change wasn't radical enough, and that they should virtually all be given jobs and given keys to their own homes.
It
sounds ridiculous.
Elizabeth goes to a daycare centre once a week, and it is a lovely lifeline. But everybody's different there. Everybody has different needs. You know, you can't lump people together and say they could all do this or they could all do that.
They're individuals.
Yes.
I mean, and this is when, although I came in for the wrong reasons, because I was using them.
Yeah.
When I worked with them and got to know them, I thought these people are a hell of a lot better than these other people that I've been with who are supposed to be normal.
They're a joy to be around, people with these disabilities, that joy of innocence, I think.
The fact is, as far as I was concerned, I wasn't going to work. It was a way of life.
Yes.
And that, quite honestly, is why I haven't stopped campaigning.
Yeah.
And I haven't stopped campaigning for 30 years because that's when it started to go wrong.
Where do you think it went wrong?
It went wrong because by 1985, we had gone through all the traumas with daycare. We'd sorted out the goods and the bads, and we were booming.
Yeah.
We really saw a future for these people.
Yeah.
But in the 1980s, a reputable organisation, you may have heard of the King's Fund Centre, does it ring a bell?
No.
They are the government's leaning post if they want opinions. The CEO of the King's Fund Centre decided that he should take some action to interpret his views on the future of training centres into action by publishing a paper. And it was a paper that was received which in effect had a one-size-fits-all solution. That there's been a big confidence trick going on for 20 to 30 years that's been reinforced by the people who should have been stopping it. These are my deepest thoughts.
Yes.
And I say it on an informed basis. This publication said in effect, these day centres are discriminating against these people. They've been released from institutions to come into the community, and now they're being segregated and stigmatised by being put in daily occupation centres. The argument was they could all be given jobs, even the most profoundly handicapped, and you've got closed training centres.
That's rubbish.
It's rubbish. It's rubbish. But I've got it. I say I've collected evidence because it's so unbelievable. If I hadn't got the evidence, I wouldn't believe it myself.
So really, these people, are they... So are we saying that academics who are out of touch don't really know what it's like? That sounds actually typical of government and things, that really, if you ask the man in the street, he's got a better idea of things than these people.
You're perfectly right. And my grievance is against the academics.
Yeah.
I'm against the academics because the universities who are teaching the present-day practitioners and psychologists and sociologists didn't look into history. They jumped on the bandwagon and went for political correctness. You had a politically correct version floating around that these people should be totally included in the community, and to group them together is counterproductive to their image.
Oh, so really, this sounds a bit to me like that three-letter word, ego. Is it all these big egos that, you know, want to be somebody at the expense of the others? It just really...
It's a whole range of things. It's a whole range of things, Vanessa. One of them is ego.
Mm.
One of them is power.
Yeah.
One of them is money.
Yeah.
One of them is status.
Yeah.
One is getting recommendations and commendations and decorations for good work.
Yeah.
It's a combination of petty things that leads the true object, which is to give these people a good life and to give their carers a good life.
Yeah. So you've written... when did you write your first book about this?
My first book is written based on a paper that I wrote in the year 2000. I had been complaining. I could see this coming because at the moment, care in the community is a debacle.
Mm.
Very few people, only the ones that are suffering, are aware of it. But care in the community has disintegrated because of the efforts of the people who've not had the foresight or the decency to look at the history to see what's gone wrong.
And of course, what happens in these situations is that instead of people holding their hands up and saying, well, actually, I got it wrong, they just keep same old heads down, same old path.
They dug a hole for themselves and they kept digging. And it got to the point where to admit they were wrong would have ruined the reputations of a lot of people.
Exactly.
In the end, it condemns the attitude of the universities who could have stopped it and done something about it, but they have reinforced it and perpetuated it.
Yeah.
After I've been campaigning for many years, I've got I'll show it to you before you go, a file an inch thick on my contacts with Mencap, because I hold a lot of people responsible for the present situation, including the charities. I began to think to myself, I'm the only one who's taking this line.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm wrong. If I'm wrong, I'll stop and I'll retire. I got in touch with the experts, the international experts, who started this going and put it on the right footing. They were two professors. And I wrote to them and said, look, you're retired. If your interest is still in these people, fine, read on. But if you're not, stop reading. And I spelled out my thoughts and I got a letter back. A letter, because emails weren't popular in those days, saying they totally supported me.
Yeah.
And they encouraged me to write because they consulted their international friends. I mean, these people were the leaders who started the whole thing going. And they consulted with their friends, colleagues in peer group in different internationally. And they all agreed that normalisation, as it was called.
Normalisation.
Has gone over the top.
Yeah.
Because we were not seen as normalising people, we're seen as still segregating them. There is a logic to it, if you've got a warped mind.
Yeah. You know, it's life really, isn't it? It's sometimes, like, if you physically get on a road and you're trying to get somewhere and you think, oh, well, eventually, you know, I might come out at the right place. But really, it's always better to go back and start again and get it right.
Right. Yeah. I mean, getting it right, it is a crucial thing.
Yeah.
Anyway, on the strength of it, they advised me To keep
going, that you were on the right road.
That I was on the right
track. You were on the right road, yeah.
And it's a sign, I think it's interesting, a sign of their feeling towards what they'd started was they said, "I'm doing it for you're doing it for our people."
Yeah.
You know, it was very touching.
Yeah.
They saw, they didn't see these as patients at the hospital. No. They were our people. They were part of it. They were part of us.
Yeah. One feels, I know that my connections, you know, I do fundraising things. But you do feel protective towards, because they're vulnerable, but they're always smiling. This is what is lovely. They, you know, and they have got probably least to smile about.
I mean, there are the exceptions, as of course.
Yeah, it's always
working with them for 25 years.
Yeah,
I saw both sides.
Yeah,
but on balance, there's no doubt about it where my understanding for normality lies. Lies with these folks. Anyway, to follow on, as a consequence, I was invited to write a paper for a reputable journal, Disability and Society.
Mm.
And I wrote a 3,000-word article, and my whole campaign and my old books are based on the contents of that article. It's a one-man story. It's a one-man story.
Yeah.
But it's a true story.
Yeah.
I wrote it. It was published in 2001. In 2000, I got no reaction. And I mean, I write these articles to provoke, if I can, a reaction deliberately on my later ones. I've tried to provoke people into
I can see another black eye coming.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I got the word. I mean, I got pushed out of a job, but which is a form of black eye. But the thing was that I got one response to that article.
How many people did it go to, do you think?
Well, the whole circulation of these journals, which were thousands in this area. Disability and Society covers a vast area.
So really, are we saying that nobody wanted to break rank and say anything?
Exactly.
Mm.
The thing was, I did get one reaction. The article was published December 2001. In 2003, I got a short letter from an American, the leading motivator for normalisation, to the point where he was notorious. And he says, "Your article in Disability and Society has been brought to my attention." And I said to myself, there is some sanity in Britain after all. That was the one response. And that came, I couldn't have got it from a higher level.
And what was his response, though?
He confirmed that I was the only voice of sanity.
Oh, right, yeah. It took a long time, though, didn't it, for it to get there?
Well, yeah, well, it shows how these things go around. This was in America, Syracuse. Yeah.
Mm.
So that was reassuring as well, that I wasn't a nutcase. I was on the right. I wrote the first book in 2005.
And that was called?
That was called Learning Disabilities. The rise and potential demise of day services for people with learning disabilities over the past 50 years.
Well, what we'll do is we'll get these listed on the website and links.
By 10 years later, to 2014, I was still discouraged. I'd been getting nowhere.
Yeah.
That I wrote what I would call an expose, if you like, because I thought I'm not going to last forever. I would like there to be known that there were real efforts to try to get things back on the right course.
Yeah.
And why they weren't put back on the right course. And I detail all the people and the stages I went through to try and get somebody, anybody with influence, to listen to me.
Yeah.
I didn't want to make a fortune out of books. I wanted there to be a message.
Yes.
I wanted to know that the parents and the carers, and many of them my own age, were going through, and they needed it. This was vital.
Yeah. Oh, it's terrible when you've got a child with disability, because all you do is worry, gosh, what's going to happen when I'm gone?
Exactly.
That's all you, I mean, you live with that.
The people are saying, my daughter sent me a clipping from the Time, they say many things, somebody writing in and saying she hopes her daughter dies before she does.
Yes. Oh, I can understand that.
You know, this is just this week. I mean, my family backed me up.
Yeah.
And anything they can do, they do.
Yeah, that's wonderful. But really, would you say that the way things are at the moment, you would like to see them return to what they were like 50 years ago with that more?
No, they have returned, Diane, to Vanessa. They've returned. And that is what worries me. The thing was, once that paper was published, that book paper, it was taken up by all the people who could gain from it. And this is where the, say, the awards and decorations and things come in. People jumped on the bandwagon that they were going to give these people a real life, not a protected life. They were going to give them a real life where they could come. They ignore the fact they were brain damaged. They would become a part of the community. The thing was, from that time onwards, it went into reverse because local authorities jumped on this. They'd been waiting for somebody to get them off the hooks. And the obligation to implement the policy for daycare and residential care was handed to local authorities in 1970. That was the year that the children were passed to education. In 1970, children went to education, adults went to social services. Social services were not happy because they couldn't take over these day centres, because these day centres, many of them, had so much about them were commercial, and were wrapped up in so many commercial affairs that the bureaucrats at County Hall couldn't handle them. So against their wishes, they let managers to manage day centres, they let residential managers manage in residences. But they resented it. So when this paper was published in 1984, local authorities jumped on the bandwagon. This is just what they wanted. Get all these people out to work, we can close the centres. One authority, coincidentally, fortunately, who took it so strongly that they wrote a book, a campaign of their own, supporting this paper. It was my authority. We had everything going, but they ignored that. The new director of social services decided he was going to be at the cutting edge, wanted to make a name for himself. So within 6 months, he got a pamphlet out. We said we were going to do the same. We were going to close all centres and we would have an office in the town where parents and carers could go for reference and for coordination.
Oh, that's just ridiculous.
This was 1987 when they agreed this was the way they... And the rundown, any funding for us as such to improve things and keep going, was withdrawn. And 40 or more other authorities wrote in to... East Sussex, which was where I was, asking for all this wonderful advice they got to give. So this was a national problem. There were 150 local authorities, each doing their own interpretation of a programme, and none of them knew where they were going. And since then, it's gone gradually, it's been eroded a bit of a time. So some centres now have gone back to where they were when I first came in 50 years ago. They're occupation centres, they're sitting around being occupied, and any hope of getting into the real community is useless. Some of them have got no centres at all.
Yeah.
Parents, I've had contact from parents who've had to get psychological support, psychiatry, help for themselves to enable them to cope. But it's not publicised because these people carry on, they stick in there and they look after their children and they don't complain. Well, partially because nobody listens and partially because they're intimidated.
Yeah.
And so, Mike, what I want is a public debate and a judicial review on why things have gone as badly wrong as they have. Because I'd hoped early on in my campaign that if I could convince somebody to hold a national debate, it would be so obvious that we would get public support to give learning disabilities a priority instead of being bottom of the heap.
I've got to finish there, Charles. As I said, for the listener, do look at the website. We'll get some details up there. What I'd like to do is to start looking into things myself. I've got your books, and obviously, because of my daughter, this is very important to me. And I'm going to see. So watch this space or listen to this space and let's see what we can come up with. But I'd like to thank you today, Charles. It's been a most interesting and informative interview. I'd like to thank you very much for your time.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I'd like to thank you too, Vanessa, for having given me the opportunity to let off steam on a topic I feel very passionately about, and I would like to see tidied up before I might my parting from Surf Paradise.
Well, we'll have to see what we can do when we join forces and put our heads together.
Great.
So thank you. So thank you. Everybody, I hope you found that as interesting as I did. In the meantime, have a great day, and till we meet again. Thank you. Bye.